Hello again, and welcome once more to Back to the Future, the Zoomcast and podcast that puts those once and future predictions, yes, we've all made them, right under the hindsight spotlight. My name is Martin Raymond, and this week I'm joined by French forecaster, strategist, writer, and fellow futurenaut, Ariane van de Ven. Ariane, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Martin, for inviting me. I'm glad we managed to make this happen.
At last, we have been pushing back, mainly because you're always traveling. I have to say, it's because
it's my fault.
Every time I speak, Ariane is somewhere else. So in fact, you know, when I'm thinking about this, I know the areas you work in, you know, they include the culture, design, architecture, technology, but all of them, and I think this is fascinating, you use these areas to help connect your clients with what's new and next and contemporary in emerging cultures. So can you just talk to us a little bit about why so many disparate things are used to bring your clients up to speed in terms of what's happening in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So my job really is to share my point of view about what's going to happen in the future with my clients. So they really pay me for my point of view. As you know, it's not an exact science. And it's really about observing, analyzing, and understanding those emerging behaviors. And I think for me, the reason why I use so much, you know, like artists, designers, architects, technologists, you know, to kind of like inform my thinking is because I started out studying art history in London. And, you know, really the main point of my studies was to understand artists, you know, like reflections and words and analyze it. So it taught me how to get into people's mind and understand what was important to them. And then when I was, when I started working, I worked at the ICA in the talks department. I work at PS1 on warm up, their summer program. And I realized that what really interested me was to connect people with culture, not be part of the art world, you know, the market side of the art world. But you know, I have kind of like a purist approach to art. Like I really want to understand the meaning behind an art piece, a design piece. And I thought it would be something that would help a lot of people in their thinking to be more creative, to be more innovative. So, you know, as I grew in my career, I always kept, you know, like connected with my art and design and architecture network. And it helped me a lot inform my thinking because artists or creative talents, I tend to call them because I don't just, you know, look at what artists are doing. They are often very extreme people because they chose to dedicate their life to their work. So they investigate areas that you and I might not think of. They also quite often, they're not scared of like criticizing what's going on and proposing different, you know, like alternatives to our way of thinking. So for me, it's a very good way to like constantly confront what I take as, you know, face value, what I think is real, confront it with other perspectives. And that's something that helps a lot, you know, like when I talk with my clients, because if I have an idea of something that's going to be important in the future, I use the work of artists, designers, architects to show how this idea is being expressed.
It is fascinating because we, I guess, as a business, tend to look at the kind of early adopter, you know, the innovator consumer, and I guess make our forecasts and our predictions from there. But I've always found it fascinating that you almost choose to sidestep that and go to one point further with, as you said, the artist, you know, the designer, the philosopher, the thinker. And I kind of find that for somebody like myself, for example, I understand that perfectly, but I wonder how much do you have to persuade a client that these are the people they should be speaking to better understand the future, say, rather than just, you know, the ordinary punter or even the early adopter consumer?
It's really interesting because I don't have to do a lot of convincing. I think because I'm very, so what I do is that I connect a lot of diverse, you know, ideas, and I make it very simple for my clients to understand why I think this idea is going to become more important in the future. So when I suggest that we invite a specific artist or designer to come and talk about their work, the connection is already made.
Right.
You know, so for them, they already see, okay, this could be really interesting for us. And sometimes with some clients, it's more in terms of aesthetic, you know, like they will be like, oh, okay, we want to meet this artist because, you know, the kind of world that they've created, they find it really beautiful or really weird, really interesting. But often when the artist comes and talks about his work, they're actually completely, you know, like inspired by it. And they, you know, it enables them to dig deeper, you know, into the mindset or the themes or preoccupations that this artist is.
It is, because again, when I think about this as a business, we spend a lot of our time, you know, doing research. It's quite factual because a lot of our clients are saying, look, we need to see the numbers behind these particular decisions. And what I liked, I've always been fascinated with, not only do you, you know, work with the artists directly, you speak to them, you're interviewing them, but you do so in their cities. So if I think about every time, as you were saying at the start of the show, like when I tried to contact you, you're in London, you're Paris, Tokyo, Barcelona, Milan, Berlin, Stockholm, and I could keep naming cities. And in fact, I think I ran into you once in Venice at the Biennale. You were just, you know, you were there doing your work. And this has always intrigued me, that you don't just do these things by Zoom, or you don't just research it online. You actually go and meet with, so you're in situ with these people. How important is that kind of presence in terms of what you learn about them and how that transmits itself to the clients you're working with?
It's super important. I mean, like for me, everything, you know, all my research, everything starts with real life encounters. So as you say, I travel a lot. I've lived in lots of different countries, and I'm always really open to meet new people. And every time I travel, my friends know I'm going somewhere and they always connect me to their own network.
Right.
So okay. Also, because I'm not really anyone, I'm not a journalist, I don't represent an institution, it's very easy for people to meet me because there's nothing at stake, you know, so they're very open, they know me, you know, I'm introduced via a friend, and I often meet them straight away in their homes or their studio, so it's very informal, you know, it has nothing to do with business, and it's really about me being curious and asking questions. And I think when you show like a genuine interest for people's work and you also have similar references to them so that you can right. understand what yeah. they're talking about, it becomes really easy to meet those people. And often when I'm in a city, the, you know, the creative talents, let's say, that I meet will want to show me other, you know, like friends of them or places that they found really interesting. So in the end, I work all the time, but it's a really.
Well, this is what I'm thinking. I imagine your kind of life of leisure and work overlap, because I am thinking about when, you know, you visit an artist or a designer and you see, you know, he, she, or their environment and how they interact with both their friends in that environment. That gives you clues as to how the rest of us may be behaving over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. And I always find that fascinating, that clients are always in awe of people who can do that. And you think, well, how can you run your business without getting out and meeting and connecting with cultures or neighborhoods or people that are really instigating the changes that will bring profits to you? And yet they always seem to be quite wary about these others, you know, these people that you and I will perhaps just know as a consequence of our travel. Because I know that again, not only do you work in different cities, but I think you've lived quite a lot in, you know, France, for example, obviously where you're from, but you live quite extensively in Spain, I think the Netherlands, and I guess in the US and also in England. So you've got all of these things where you've absorbed culture differently. How do you think that has changed the way you work, having these connections with kind of different parts of the world?
But it totally informs my work because I mean, I myself, you know, you say I'm French because like I'm born in France, but my mom's side is Russian and my dad's side is Corsican Italian. So I come from, it's my great grandparents who came to Paris, and I grew up in République in Paris, you know, which is a super multicultural area. So for me, you know, like I've always been aware of different cultures and the value of different cultures and way of thinking or behaving. And it's very interesting, the whole debate about cultural appropriation at the moment, because like I grew up with that, you know, with like, I would wear, you know, boo-boo, you know, wax, I would wear Chinese jackets and stuff like that. And it really had nothing to do with, you know, being disrespectful to the culture. It was on the contrary, you know, like being really interested, but, you know, by the culture. So for me, the world is what I work with. You know, it's never been France, Europe, or whatever. And it's really important because you can see trends in a country and you understand they're very cultural. It's embedded within their culture.
Yes. Yeah.
So it gives you an indication of how it might evolve in other countries where it's emerging. So that's really interesting. And I think also today, most of the brands, you know, like they are global brands. So it's something I found really interesting working with really large groups, you know, like they will have a really big part of their business in Latin America, for instance, and they would go, you know, 3-4 times a year to Latin America to meet their distributors, for instance. But know very little about the markets, the differences between the different countries. And therefore they're not pushing their brands as much as they could and connecting with consumers as best as they could. So all the work that I do is always global. Like I actually almost have like a grid when I'm writing a trend, and I want to have examples from all around the world.
Yeah.
But sometimes when I research a topic, I realize actually this is really strong in the Middle East. Like this is really something that's a really big preoccupation there. Or this is really big in Asia. And it's, again, it's connected to like the, you know, the embedded culture of those markets. So it's very important. And
One of the things I'm curious, because you mentioned cultural appropriation, and I'm aware as forecasters and as kind of, you know, futurists, people who look at the future, a lot of the time you are having to look at culture and to look at signs within cultures that will give us clues or hints as to where things could be in the future. And I constantly have this debate recently where people are saying, well, you know, if this is solely Irish, for example, where I come from, is it right that you take that and you look at it in a wider context as to how it will affect, say, England or America, or the same with you know, Middle Eastern culture being, you know, taken into Europe? And I was kind of thinking, is there a difference between how you appropriate in a negative way, so you're taking things that are stereotypes and magnifying, versus how you're taking cultural norms and making them more available and intelligible and understanding. So people go, actually, these things are part of what we should be looking to as well. Or how do you feel about the kind of current debates that we're beginning to see around whether if you have a cultural trait that I like, I shouldn't borrow it because by doing that, I'm somehow undermining or undervaluing your particular cultural standpoint?
Well, I think it's about being, you know, respectful and understanding the culture that you appropriate from, I guess. Like for me, you know, I love fashion.
Yep.
So everywhere I travel, I will, and I've been doing that since I'm a kid. So I will, you know, I've got a collection of vintage kimonos that I wear in Tokyo with my own clothes. You know, I went to Nigeria and the mom of my friend had dresses made for me, and she was extremely happy that I wanted to wear those dresses.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm in Andalusia at the moment and I did my birthday there 2 years ago. I had a gold flamenca dress made for me, and I had the people from the village that I invited, you know, like for my birthday. So I think if you do it in a way, because you really admire something, you really respect it, and you also ask people,
I guess it's that tension between being global. You know, we're living in this spaceship called Earth, and there are lots of things we should be aware of and you know, I think borrow from. I think we should be borrowing and we should be using and referencing and enjoying that diversity that sits, you know, across the planet. But I think with you know, forecasting increasingly, I think there is a tension where you are asked, obviously, because you're working for a brand who works internationally, and they're asking you for international nuance. The question is, are you reporting nuance as you see it? Are you interpreting it for the sake of giving it a particular spin? Or I think, as a lot of us are doing now, is you're working with, I guess, local teams who are giving you their view or their sense of how this trend will play out. But do you think there will become a point where it will be difficult for a forecaster to do their job because you have issues about, you know, cultural appropriation, issues about, you know, kind of gender perception, equality, etc.? Or do you think that that's something, as forecasters, we can manage fairly well?
I think we can manage very well, but I think it's very important, you know, the same way when I talk to an artist, I'm not an artist myself, you know, like I'm curious about the work, but I'm very humble, you know, like when I ask questions. It's the same thing when you tackle a market. So one of the things I've done for my clients is I design a workshop, and it's like an immersive one-day workshop. So I would pick a space outside of the office, and everything during the day would be related to the region or the country that we're trying to understand deeper. Right. So for that, I would work with experts in that region. So people who live in that region, who have worked in that region, and I would brief them on different topics, because of course I can do desk research and I can travel to some countries, but I will never be an expert on the Middle East, for instance.
Exactly,
the Middle
yes.
East, the, it's changing a lot. The differences between the countries are huge. So this is a really good way of getting clients to understand, you know, in one day, at least you give them tools, if they want to get a better understanding of the region. So that's what I do, but yeah.
Yes, I mean, one of the things I've certainly noticed from following your work is while you talk about artists a lot, and I was always amazed at how much art informed your thinking, which I thought is quite rare, not was quite rare, but is quite rare generally. You also have a vast knowledge or friendship groups, you know, poets, you know, geneticists, scientists. So I quite like the rap artists. I quite like the idea that you really bring to your thinking an ecosystem of diversity that is quite unusual. And my question is, how do you physically manage? Like, are you a kind of a proactive networker, or are you just doing it on a project per project basis? Just give me a bit more insight as to how you, and I guess this is for a listener as well, how you think we should manage our networks more effectively and strategically.
So I think you need to really like people.
Right. That's me
the
out.
Number one thing. You need, no, but you really need to, because I actually, the reason why I have such a big network is because I'm always up for meeting someone. Always. It's very, very rare I say no. And especially when I travel, if my friends tell me you have to meet this person, I will move things and make sure I meet this person. So you need to make yourself available. And actually, it's a better way to meet people when you don't have an agenda. When you don't know, you're going with an open mind. You know via your network that it might be somebody interesting, but you're not placing expectations on that meeting. And like that, I've had amazing surprises. You know, I have almost like fixers, you know, for like all the trips I do. And to manage it is, I'm genuinely interested in the people that I meet in their lives. I want to know if they are okay. You know, during the confinement, I did a lot of FaceTime and Zooms with my friends. Some of them, you know, like for instance, in Mexico City, it was quite hardcore, the situation. So they would walk me, you know, like through the city to show me how things were going on. Yeah, so and every time I go back somewhere, I always go back and meet the people, even though I don't have a project, you know. I think it's being genuinely interested in...
It's interesting because you're sort of articulating there. I'm doing quite a lot of work at the moment on networks and how networks will develop post-COVID. And, you know, the obvious things we know about networks, that sort of, you know, serendipity. So it is, so a lot of it can be accidental. Openness, so being open, as you say. Weak ties. So the people actually who are not as close to us have more to give us than those people that we know, because the further we are from our network center, the more likely it is to meet people who don't know what we know. So they kind of bring a, you know, different brightness to the network. And also, and I think this is, you know, with your work generally, is unlike-minded people. I mean, somebody said to me recently, the real networks are successful because you're with unlike-minded people. Because if you're with like-minded people, you know what they know. But if you're with somebody who disagrees with you, you start learning. So really, that's the kind of, I guess, from your networks. Every time I meet you, I think, oh my gosh, how do you know that person? How did you teach? And that's really what I was kind of learning from you. One of the other thing would be good just to talk us through the actual physical ways you would go about, because again, I'm quite structured about my network management, which is, you know, I set up interviews, I will research people beforehand. I kind of think I need to know what I'm getting from them. So I'm quite unusual for somebody like an Irishman like myself. I'm quite structured and strategic. And I get the sense that yours is much more fluid, but you still know, you have instincts about what it is you're trying to get from these people in terms of you know, how they may help you to look at the future.
Yeah, no, like you, I mean, I research people before meeting them. I research the, you know, the city where I'm going, and I have ideas of, you know, questions, themes that I want to explore. But because I do everything very informally, you know, I don't really take notes, you know, I'm not recording people. People, you know, open up, and often they put me on a different path, because of that, because it's not structured, you know, it's very, it's very informal. And also what you were saying before, meeting people in their homes or their studios, that gives you, you know, clues and insights that they would not tell you. So often I go and I'm like, oh, you have this thing, or you've read this book. And then we start talking about other things.
Wow. So this is the question I always ask forecasters, and each one gives me, gladly, a completely different answer. And I remember when I was interviewing you for my book, when you were describing your methodology, it was very close to how, because my background was fashion, it was how I used to work in fashion. And I would just like you, perhaps, for listeners who may be, you know, doing our masterclasses and thinking about how they will develop their own methodology, if you could just talk to us for a few moments about the process you go through to arrive at a forecast or a prediction, just like a few stages that people can go, wow, I can do that as well.
Yeah, so everything for me starts with observation, you know, what we were saying, traveling a lot, meeting a lot of people. And because I'm naturally attracted to the weird and the unusual, you know, I tend to observe a lot of, out of the norms, let's say, thinking and behaviors. And for me to start thinking, you know, about a trend, it often starts when I don't understand something. So I talk with someone, they say something, or they have an approach to something that I don't understand. And usually I make a note of it. And I'm like, I need to, you know, get to the bottom of this. I need to understand what's the emotional driver behind this, you know, unusual behavior or way of thinking. And this sticks in my head. And often when I meet this first person, then I start noticing other people who have the same behavior. So then I start researching, okay, is it coming from the same place? Because sometimes it doesn't, you know, like sometimes people exhibit, you know, like similar behaviors, but it comes from a really different emotional driver. But I really try to understand that. And then I will start, you know, like researching. So like doing desk, you know, like research. I read a lot of books, you know, philosophy books, sociology books. I watch a lot of movies. I read a lot of magazines, all those things. And I start making connections. And what I really want to get out is, what is the emotional driver behind this new type of behavior and mindset? Because that's going to help me with my clients, make them understand how they can connect with this specific typology of consumer. And then from the emotional driver, I try to understand, you know, I believe we all have a hierarchy, you know, in our lives of values, of things that are important for us. And they change, you know, throughout our lives because of our personal, you know, things that happen to us, but also because of what's happening in the world, like the pandemic, I think has shifted a lot of the hierarchies that we thought we had in place and were working for us. So for each of the typology, I really try to understand the value that those people are getting from, you know, exhibiting this behavior or having this mindset. And then I try to understand what is the currency. So what is going to be the thing that's that they're going to, you know, to cherish.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. It's interesting. You've described quite a complex methodology. You know, if you think about the observational side to it, how much you put into that, then the investigation, you know, how much, again, you look across subjects and read into them. And then I guess the bit that other people would be curious about too is your intuition, because a lot of the time, and particularly if you come from a fashion background, we tend to see intuition as really the key thing. And yet over the past decade, a lot of businesses have tried to sidestep that because they want proof and they want facts and they want case studies. And yet I remind people at the end of the day, intuition is the sum total of your life experience that you're bringing to bear on a single issue. What is your kind of take on the intuitive bit of forecasting?
I call it informed intuition. Right. I think you're totally right. I think that's what I explain to people. It's my job. It's not a hobby. It's my job, and it takes my whole time. And I'm working all the time. You know, on holidays I'm still working because I'm still thinking. So it is informed intuition. And then, you know, I'm never wrong in what I put in my trends because it's really, really heavily researched. And I remember when I was working with Telefonica, you know, my audience was engineers, business strategy people, VCs, really super smart people, but very, very Cartesian, you know, type people. And I was like, okay, how am I gonna be able to embark them into my thinking, you know, and convince them that what I'm seeing is really going to become more important in the future, is going to shape the future. And what I would do is I had access to analysts from different industries, you know, like, so I would speak to Gartner, to Forrester, and I would ask them, do you see more investment in these types of company? Do you see progressions in these types of technologies and innovation? And I would use, you know, like this data to support, you know, and yeah, well, what I was, you know, saying to the engineers.
So it's support, because one of the things you talk about Telefonica, and you've also worked with probably one of Europe's biggest fragrance manufacturers. I mean, they do, you know, fragrance from Jean-Paul Gaultier to Com. Dries Van Noten. I'm kind of thinking about there, you know, you think about telecoms, which is very much about the, you know, hardware, electronics, very much about the solid world. And then I go into fragrance, which is very much about the ethereal place in the world and, you know, these kind of things of sense triggers. How do you shift your skills, or do you think you need to shift your skills? Is it the same thing that you're simply just looking at through another filter? How would you describe from your work with Telefonica to your work with fragrances? What were is there a difference? Actually, that's my question.
It is different. My methodology is the same. It's exactly the same. However, with Telefonica, because I ended up working in R&D, so directly with, you know, like computer scientists, engineers to develop new innovations. And the idea with Telefonica was to understand, have a vision for the future, and see how technology could help better people's lives. So we would look at society as a whole, you know, at communities, and then of course at individuals, and see what would be the opportunities in the future, you know, with new tech innovations. So that was amazing because you have a sense of self-worth, you know, because you're like, oh my God, I'm helping underdeveloped communities, you know, underserved communities in Latin America. I'm helping farmers. I'm doing stuff with people, you know, older people, so that they can stay connected. So the problems that we could tackle, the challenges that we could try to answer, were really, really big, and that was amazing. With Puig, it was different because the connection is really with the individual. Like fragrance is something that's very personal, and it's something that is ethereal. You don't really need fragrance, but yet people wear fragrance. It evokes something, you know, like for them. So I realized that I would focus my work on the individual and on their very own aspirations, mindsets, but really for themselves, not so much in, you know, the way they connect, you know, like with the rest of society. So it gave me a lot more creative license, you know, and that's where, you know, like it's a company I would invite top artists, you know, to come and give talks. You know, we had Mélie Coagnon, Jeremy Shaw, Marguerite Humeau, you know, because they understood you know, the importance of dreaming and creativity. So that was it's very different in terms of the output, but in the end, the actual core of what I would talk about would be the same, but presented really differently.
Yeah, you see, it's interesting because a lot of people, I remember initially when we set up a business 20 years ago, people said, "Well, you're a trend forecaster." And I was thinking, well, not really. You're trying to identify solutions and opportunities. And that's really, I think, the process that a lot of people forget. If they see the trend as being the important thing, and I would go without any sense of how this thing will pan out or how it impacts or how, for example, it can kick up an opportunity. There is no point in you know, looking at trends in that sense of the word. And I really kind of think you've hit on it here and you've said it really clearly that what you're trying to do, you talk about the challenges and then you talk about the solutions. And really, I suppose one part of the program I always push people on a little bit is where the forecast you made that, you know, initially you got it wrong. I was thinking, you know, my incorrect forecast. And then I go, actually, it wasn't wrong. It was either the context was wrong or actually it was maybe ahead or it's taught me something else. Has anything like that happened to you in your career that you go, wow, if I was to do that again, I would have considered it differently? That's your challenge for this week.
So clients don't ask me, you know, like I'm not the forecaster that will tell you by, you know, 2050, you know, like
we'll be doing this and flying cars.
But there's one topic that's very important to me, and I think that should be very important in society, that hasn't evolved as much as I expected, is it's our attitudes towards aging.
Right.
And it's something when I started, like my first job, I was working for a trans agency in Paris. And my big boss was a senior. He was quite old. He had founded the agency. And he was doing presentations about aging and the need, you know, like to shift mindsets. And we would go to like all these big companies and nothing happened.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. And it's really, you know, really something that's baffling to me, especially in Europe, because we're going to have one of the most, you know, the oldest population, and we are not prepared for it. It's kind of like we're resisting the inevitable. Yeah. And also all the, you know, the gloominess that's attached to it. You know, the commercials are always really naff when you present, you know, older people. I think it's not only bad, you know, because it's just bad marketing, but it's also really bad for individuals, because I see a lot of people who are so scared of aging, you know?
Yeah. Oh gosh, and, yeah. I guess the psychology of it, because I'm about to celebrate my 60th birthday this year. And because of that, when you turn 55, something clicks on your computer and you start getting ads for retirement. Yeah. Funeral insurance, cruise ships, you know, why suddenly I've never considered a cruise ship in my life and I turned 55 or whatever and I'm meant to be on a cruise. And I felt that it wasn't just depressing and limiting. It was actually writing a potential future for myself that was undesirable and actually, you know, quite depressing. And I, that's the bit, I guess, where we've probably all taken part in unknowingly, you know, where we see age as both a shutting down of you know, both intellect, and also that as you get older, you somehow are a bit wealthier and therefore you've got time to indulge. And there's all of the tropes that I think sit with it. And then the alternative is I guess you have probably done this when you're working with a client, and we talk about flat age, and we talk about, you know, the kind of young 50 something, and you realize we're still selling an alternative image. So we've gone from selling the decrepit, that sort of bent over person with the stick, to somebody who's quite robust and healthy and running and jogging. And I think neither are truthful. They're not truthful. And as forecasters, maybe we need to construct a third way that perhaps offers people healthy optimism. I just feel this: either I'm going to be a Superman and I'm going to break my neck in the process of doing it, or I am doomed to go on cruise ships around the world forever and ever.
Exactly. And I, like, for me, what I do with this, I don't know if you remember this speech that Riz Ahmed did, I think it was at the parliament, when he was talking about the importance of representation, and also it's the responsibility of, you know, he was talking about studios. But, you know, in my case, it's brands. For me, brands have a responsibility. They're creating tons of images and they're building up aspirations for people. And so it's very hard to project yourself if you are not represented, you know?
Yes.
The same issue that, you know, people have because of, you know, like their cultural background is the same thing with age. And so for me, in all the trends that I write, in all my typologies, I will find older people who represent that typology, because I also think I hang out with a lot of really young people, like, you know, 18 years old, like the kids of my friends now, you know, and it's really interesting because they have no issue with cross-generational, you know, like meetings. Like, they never treat me as like an old person, like I could be their mom, but they don't see me like that. They just say, oh, she's cool, like we like similar things. So I have a lot of hope for the young generation, but I know my generation and above, it's really something that is an issue for me, because I'm like, you need to be able to see yourself positively. It doesn't have to be superwoman and looking like a 30-year-old when you're 60, but you need to be able to envision a good future when you're older, you know?
Well, I guess that's the job of, in some ways, the futurist, is to fashion those alternatives where people can feel both comfortable, you know, feel positive, engaged. Because, I think also the other issue is there aren't enough differences out there. And I think in the process of you know, diversity and inclusion, I think age has almost been left out of the debate, the argument. Because in our business, where, you know, we've got a range of age groups, and I hear a lot of debates about, you know, inclusion, diversity, you know, how we need to do more. And I'm thinking, gosh, nobody's mentioned the elephant, i.e. me. I'm the elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. Nobody talks about this old elephant here, because they kind of go, well, it's just an assumed thing that because you were there, that's good enough. And I work in a lot of businesses, and I'm sure you do this, where you walk into the workplace, and while, yes, among senior management, you will find older people, you don't find older people among, you know, or, you know, worker groups. You just do not see multi-generational work teams. You don't see multi-generational marketing teams, etc. And if you don't see that, my fear is that therefore we're not speaking. So everything is directed towards the 20-something, the 30-something. And then when I get to my bemusement, the ad for the cruise ship or the retirement fund or the funeral service recently, I was offered a discount on my first funeral, which was great, but I'm thinking, I'm not planning to die yet. And I just find that these things that we now perhaps need to have a more inclusive view about what futures could be. So on that note, because this is the bit where I say to you, to look ahead in the market, what do you think are going to be the big issues that we need to embrace now that maybe we're not really thinking about in the way we should be thinking about them?
So one of them is related to what we just talked about. It's changes in the workplace. You know, like for me, I've worked in lots of different companies with different culture, but during the confinement, you know, like COVID and everything, I was really bewildered by the differences between, you know, like French and Spanish management, for instance, compared to, you know, UK or, you know, US companies. And I think we really need to, companies really need to change. So I think they need to, you know, keep older people in the workplace, because there's a, especially in innovation, when I worked in innovation, I needed somebody who had worked on education projects for 20 years to work with me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so we would bring in consultants that were 55 plus, you know, to help us, because we just simply didn't have the history or the knowledge. But I think it's also understanding that people need to be more fluid in their career path. So not just, you know, you study one thing and you stay in that job and then you work up the corporate ladder, because I see that a lot, that people are not satisfied with that and they want to be able to change path. And it doesn't necessarily have to mean leaving the company, but it's like being able to like reinvent yourself.
In that business, I agree.
Yeah.
And maybe even to be, you know, the notion that education, if you think about it, stops at 23, 24. I know in France, you intelligently take it a lot further, but certainly by 30, we're out of education. And yet, probably, we are least equipped for learning at those early stages of our life. We should be doing that mid-year. So I guess, to me, 45 to 55 should be a re-entry point for education. So for businesses, for universities to have, you know, older cohorts, so that we're maybe preparing for the third way, you know, the third generation of our life, that kind of 55 plus.
Exactly. But it's also learning things that are outside of your day-to-day work.
Right.
So, you know, in France, we have a fund for training, like every employee has that. And every year you can do training. And one year, and, you know, most of it is leadership, you know, stuff like that, like really, you know, corporate stuff. And I asked my boss, I was like, listen, I don't want to do leadership. I've done tons of those training. It doesn't, you know, it's not, I don't need that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I want to do screenwriting, because I write stories and I write scripts for videos for my trans. And I did that. And it was amazing for me, you know, it actually really helps me in my work, you know, for future scenario planning.
Oh, without a doubt. I have to say, we, you know, we did in the masterclass, we did a couple of sessions on, you know, narrative storytelling, speculative fiction, you know, creating plots. And initially people were saying, well, why would you want to do that as part of forecasting? I said, well, surely all forecasting is about storytelling and about forward momentum and about motivational activity and drivers, you know, drivers being those hidden things that sit inside the actor or the character that compel them to do a particular thing in a particular way. So I think all of those things, but also I think hugely important for any business. So again, to your point, I suspect that a lot of the times training is just very corporate and strategic rather than, I mean, somebody told me recently they were doing a course on kindness. And initially I had a laugh, and then I thought, my gosh, that's such a brilliant course. You know, the fact that we need, and we should be teaching people to be kind, because actually kindness isn't part of the corporate requirement.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I think she was brilliant about. She said, Martin, if we were kinder in business and kinder in the future, and I thought, gosh, this is a new way to look at the future, thinking about things like kindness, like, you know, good reciprocity. How do you teach people to be reciprocal? Because in that way, then you teach them to respect people and to enjoy difference, but also to benefit from it mutually. So I guess that's the bit of the future I'm increasingly keen on, are those soft skills that we were dismissing, but now increasingly they are becoming the things that the work environment needs if I think we are to get to this next stage. Because I suspect business are going to become more about culture. You know, to your point about all of having all of these artists there will increasingly be seen to be important. The adjective of a business surely must be as important as the fact. And then I guess the other bit I'm keenest on is how these things become more federated, and they're still hierarchical. I mean, you know, you work, and this is why I kind of would like you to kind of, as we're coming to the end of the podcast, you're about to start on a new business. You've set up your own business. You're setting out in the world now completely different. What's your ambition for what you would like? And what have you learned from your past work that you will carry forward into this future that I guess you're going to build for yourself?
Yeah, I think for me, it's been really interesting because I started agency side. So as a trans consultant, I was a planner and And so I was used to work with lots of different clients and across different industries. And then over the past 10 years, I've been client side and I set up trans departments. And it's been really interesting because I've seen the shift, you know, from when I arrived at O2, you know, it was 2009 and people were like, okay, what is really this position? How it's going to really impact us? And to now, you know, like it's really embedded into the Telefonica, you know, innovation process. You know, they collaborate with artists, with chefs, you know, as part of the innovation process. And at Pooch, I got to know like a completely different, you know, industry. I didn't know anything about fragrance and, you know, working with fashion houses also was really interesting. I think for me, having worked client side, I understand hierarchies, politics within the companies. But what I want to be able to do is to use, you know, like all the experience that I have working across, you know, lots of different markets, lots of different industries, and use that for you know, my different clients. So now when you give me, you know, if you give me a topic about, you know, the future of entertainment or mobility, the way I will respond to this is very different, having had this, you know, client side experience and also a more in-depth experience.
Will you, as a lot of people I know who've started up their own businesses, they've not taken on any new teams or staff. They've decided they're going to run it, when I use that word federated, but they're also going to run it through networks. So how will you structure this kind of new kind of offer you're going to target clients with?
Yeah, so I work on my own, but I have this huge network of experts. And that's why people come to me. They know that if they give me a brief, you know, in one day, I have 10, 15 people I can reach out to who are experts in that field and who will give me different perspectives on the topic at hand. So that's the way I work, you know, like it's me and my network.
Perfect. But even, I guess then the will you have a view about the kind of businesses? Because again, I know I was talking to somebody recently who really had set out to work with businesses that had, you know, were purposeful, that had a sense of integrity, that had a sense of you know, passion and belief in what they were doing. I said, gosh, you're in trouble, because not every business has that particular viewpoint. And I was quite amazed and impressed that they turned down quite a big piece of work, because I just felt, and it was a you know, an energy company, and the energy systems weren't particularly too damaging, but they just felt they weren't being transparent enough. And I've kind of found that a fascinating. I think, would I be as brave as them setting out now doing the thing? And I'm just wondering how much of your principles will be informed in the way you work with clients, or what's your thinking about, you know, the balance between earning a living, I guess, and actually having principles that fit in front of you know, you saying yes or no to a client work?
Yeah, well, I think for me, I think even businesses who are not doing necessarily what I would hope them to do, but who are in need of change and realize that, you know, I would work with, because, you know, like the purpose of what I do is to help business do better, be more meaningful for consumers, you know. So, and I like working across completely different industries. So, and I think also you can gauge whether it's going to be a good working relationship or not from the get-go, you know, when you get the brief. It's like, if you agree on the objectives, it doesn't really matter which industry the client is working on. You can do some good work.
Agreed. I mean, I guess it is this thing about good work and fulfilling work, but also, and I'm not sure if you've come across this, that to me the most frustrating bit in doing what we're doing is that we sometimes never see the outcome of a work, because either it sits under NDA or it is over a long time frame and you never hear from the client, and maybe by accident you come across something that you discussed with them 3 years ago, and then it's out in the marketplace. Does that bother you, or do you still feel fulfilled just by doing the work, or are you a bit like me, frustrated because you never get to see the final outcome of what that work looks like?
No, I'm not frustrated, because like for me it's really the process, you know, like we do this job every day. So for us, a lot of the things that we know are very obvious, you know, but to be able to share our knowledge with people who don't have time to look at the stuff we look at, that's really what I like. You know, I like taking people to a place they would have never gone to before. You know, I love when people have you know, like they're very closed and they're like, no, I will not like this artist. There's nothing to do in this city. And I'm like, okay, I'm gonna show you and I'm gonna change your mind. So it's really the process I enjoy. And I also know it's part of what we do. It takes time, you know, from the trend, from the inside, from everybody aligning behind a common objective, once we've done our work, to make things happen. So it's not something that...
You're much more optimistic and patient than I am. Now, just how can people get in touch with you? If they're here today, they go, actually, I'd like to kind of work with Ariane. How can they get in touch with you over the next few weeks?
Well, first of all, you have to connect with me on Instagram, because I just launched it on Wednesday and I have 40 followers. So
oh, well, then I can help you get 50.
Thank you.
I can help you get 50. One even.
So my Instagram is at Ariane van de Ven. It's very simple, just my name. And my website is www.arianevandeven.com.
So it's www.arianevandeven.com. Perfect. I will connect to your Instagram site. We will also make sure that the accompanying blog with this piece will, of course, have all of your contacts on it. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week. So hopefully everybody's enjoyed themselves today. If, as usual, you have any questions, please let me know and I can pass them on to Ariane, or if not, I can try to answer them myself. So until next time, hope everybody keeps listening, looking and learning, of course, and asking about what's new and what's next. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin.